Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're broadcasting live through our PRN studio in New York. We have a lot of good information to share today, and we begin always with the latest on health and healing. Well, I'm going to talk about a supplement that can help treat acute kidney injury. Korean red ginseng can alleviate addictive effects of alcohol. Constipation is linked to 73% higher risk of cognitive decline. And short bursts of daily activity is linked to reduced cancer risk. Fermented vegetables found to possibly impact our gut health. And new research finds fruit can convert bad fat into good fat. Well, that's brand new. And we like to always present something that you haven't heard before. From Duke University Medical School, an article published in the Peer Journal of Lipid Research shows that the omega-3 fatty acid lipids, the fats in them, could treat acute kidney injury. And that's very important. And it comes from a long-running research program at Duke, their medical school, investigating how cells take up a specialized omega-3 lipid called LPC-DHA. And DHA, of course, is the active ingredient, the healing ingredient in your omega-3 fatty acids. I suggest about 1,500 milligrams in the morning and 1,500 milligrams in the evening of your omega-3 fatty acids. Now, a major public health concern is kidney failure. About 13 million adults around the world suffer each year, and the mortality rate is up to 50%, depending upon the economic status of the country and the stage of the disease. And one of the main causes of this is ischemic reperfusion injury, which occurs when the kidney's blood supply is restored after a period of restricted blood flow and poor oxygen delivery due to illness and injury and surgical intervention. So it's a serious health problem. So something that is natural and non-toxic that can make a difference would be welcomed, and it is. And it's passed through all the hurdles, so the omega-3 fatty acids can help. Also from Simuk University in South Korea, Korean red ginseng can alleviate addictive effects of alcohol. We know vitamin C works, especially intravenous, to take away the addiction and get a person into recovery very fast. But alcohol is one of the most commonly used psychoactive drugs, with a growing number of users, not less, more, in spite of all the science showing there is no such thing as a safe drink. And despite the awareness regarding its adverse effects, individuals can get habituated to alcohol consumption, leading to a medical condition called alcohol use disorder, or AUD. Recent studies have reported the beneficial effects of Korean red ginseng extract, that's a traditional herbal medicine, in treating neuroinflammation. Now, although it's been traditionally used to treat a number of ailments, it's now finding use in diseases of the modern day, like cardiovascular disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's. And previous research on rodents has demonstrated that Korean red ginseng can relieve addiction against psychoactive agents. However, not much is known about the effects of alcohol-induced addictive responses and cognitive impairment. So adding to the existing body of literature, researchers from Korea sought to find out if Korean red ginseng extract attenuates addictive responses to alcohol in mice. The key findings of the study suggest yes. So the takeaway message is simple. If you know someone who's been drinking and you want to get them off, then red Korean ginseng. From Rush University Medical Center, constipation is linked to 73% higher risk of cognitive decline. Around 16% of the global population experience constipation. And risk factors would be low levels of physical activity, female gender, residential location, medical conditions, including depression, hemorrhoids, and other cardiovascular and gastrointestinal and musculoskeletal conditions, and stress. Stress is a big one, and lack of fiber. And chronic constipation occurs when a person has fewer than one bowel movement every 3 or more days. It's been linked to various health conditions, including anxiety and depression. The more anxious, the more depressed, the more constipation. Well, studies show that constipation is a common complication of neurological conditions like Parkinson's, and is linked also to faster Alzheimer's and dementia disease progression. So keeping that intestine clean, keeping yourself regular, it's not difficult. All you have to do is, well, exercise daily. Start your day with some apple, lemon, and green apple, lemon, and celery juice. That really opens you up. 4 ounces of coconut water, that gives you lots of potassium and really helps with constipation. So there's plenty of ways of doing this. The more berries you have, the less constipation. So all the different fibers, nut fibers, grain fibers, legume, pulse fibers, starchy vegetable fibers, fruit fibers, they're all good for you. In this particular study, there were 112,753 men and women, and it was over a period of time, 3 years, and it showed an enhancement of cognition. Quote, they also had a 73% higher risk of subjective cognitive decline in fewer microbes than produced by bitrate, a marker of healthy bacteria that help digest dietary fibers. Meaning, if you don't have enough fiber in the diet, you have a 73% higher risk of cognitive decline. And you have to have probiotics also. From the University of Sydney, which of course is in Australia, an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Oncology, they found that short bursts of daily activity linked to reduced cancer risk. That's important. I suggest that every couple hours go for a little walk, a brisk walk, make part of that walk fast. I suggest doing some sit-ups, push-ups, having some light weights wherever you work, and doing some curls, and then do fast curls. Quote, as few as 4 to 5 minutes of vigorous intermittent lifestyle physical activity was associated with a substantially lower cancer risk compared to those who undertook none of that. Okay, so that's not a lot, all right? And they did a study with 22,398 people. And that's important, big study. And also, fermented vegetables. There's kimchi, and you've got sauerkraut. Any of your fermented vegetables are found to be positively impacting your gut health. University of Minnesota says, fermented foods have grown in popularity and are widely consumed, in part due to claims regarding their positive effects on digestive health. However, these claims lack scientific support, especially in lacto-fermented vegetables. So a team did the research on these lacto-fermented vegetables like kimchi, kraut, and any effect on the trillions of bacteria that make up the gut. And so they put people in this study. They measured and tested for what kind of bacteria they had in their gut. And then they had them consume these fermented vegetables, and the lacto-fermented vegetables have a significantly greater effect on some of the functions performed by microorganisms in your gut and the nutrients that our microbiome uses to perform functions with potentially key effects on health. And it worked. So fermented vegetables, big deal, make a big difference. And in helping you have healthier gut bacteria, which means your whole immune system is healthier. And finally, from Washington State University, what if indulging in your favorite raspberries and blueberries and grapes and other fruits this summer could help you burn stubborn stores of fat? Well, that may be just possible, according to a new study published in the International Journal of Obesity. The study examines how a substance known as resveratrol, R-E-S-V-E-R-A-T-R-O-L, resveratrol, which is found in many fruits, induces a brown-like adipocyte formation in white fat through activation of AMP-activated protein kinase, or O1, end quote. In other words, in lay language, eating 2 or 3 servings of berries and grapes, as well as other fruits daily, can convert bad fat stored in our bodies into calorie-burning good fat. How about that? That's good news. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break because we have a really interesting show lined up. And we're going to ask you, if you're interested, please call and share your thoughts. Our talk back number is 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm going to share with you now verbatim an article from Epoch Times from a doctor and professor, Klaus Steger, S-T-E-G-E-R. And if you look at his background, you can Google it. He is very esteemed in his field of molecular biology and genes. And he's sharing something that no one knew. They knew, the people who manufactured and gave you the vaccine, but no one knew this. If you did know this, I'm quite sure you would have used your freedom of choice differently. The title of the article is The Truth Behind RNA-Based Vaccine Technology, Part 1. COVID-19 vaccines and boosters were never made with RNA. Okay, here's what he has to say. Quote, for the first time in human history, the gene regulatory program of healthy people has been manipulated on a massive scale. Despite everything we've been told, RNA-based COVID injections were manufactured with modified RNA, not messenger RNA. Modified RNA poses substantial risk to our health. Let me repeat that. Modified RNA, that's what you got in your injections, poses a substantial risk to our health. These risks come not only from COVID-19 injections and boosters, but unless we speak up now, also from all future RNA-based vaccines. RNA and modified RNA are not the same. The two, RNA and modified RNA, are completely different. RNA occurs naturally, lives in our cells for only a short time, and is relatively fragile. It is a specific type of RNA that carries instructions or messages from our genes to make proteins and the building blocks of our cells. It is constantly produced as part of normal cellular processes. Once RNA delivers the messages, its work is done and it's broken down into the body. When RNA from another source enters our cells, virus RNA, for example, these cells can generate virus proteins. We've been told that COVID-19 injections are made with RNA. However, a vaccine using natural RNA would not last long enough to initiate an immune response before being destroyed by our immune systems. To make RNA useful for routine medicine, and scientists had to artificially modify RNA, increase both its efficiency and lifetime. The result, modified RNA. Modified RNA has been optimized for long life and maximum translation. And while RNA exhibits a cell-specific expression pattern, modified RNA can invade nearly every cell type. How did we get here? In 1961, the announcement of the discovery of RNA occurred, quote, in a climax of scientific excitement, end quote. There have been earlier, quote, sightings, end quote, of this short-lived but essential RNA intermediary, all leading up to an understanding of how genes made RNA and its role in the production of proteins. In a nutshell, natural RNA carries genetic instructions from the cell's DNA to ribosomes, which use these instructions to assemble a specific protein. It wasn't long before scientists experimented with how to use RNA to help the body heal itself. In 1990, researchers injected natural, unmodified RNA into a mouse's skeletal muscle. The mouse produced a protein it would never produce naturally. Scientists observed that transferring natural RNA was inefficient, although it worked in principle. It broke down quickly and couldn't be used effectively for treating purposes. This observation opened the door to synthetically and artificially modifying RNA. The original focus of this research was to reprogram and destroy cancer cells, the only aim of modified RNA before the COVID pandemic. Modified RNA 101. How is RNA modified? Simply put, one of the four compounds in RNA is modified. e.g. natural nucleoside, uridine, is modified to make synthetic artificial methyl pseudouridine. The modified RNA is then more stable, meaning it lasts longer in the body, less immunogenic, meaning it evokes reduced stimulation of the innate immune system, and it's more efficient. The modified RNA produces more protein than the same amount of natural RNA. Modified RNA is created in the laboratory. The therapeutic application of modified RNA is in humans presents challenges and dangers. Alarmingly, modified RNA contains a viral gene sequence. Upon entering a cell, the modified RNA takes control of the cell machinery and reprograms it to produce a viral protein. For example, spike protein is what it produces, and perhaps most astonishing is that when creating the COVID vaccines and boosters, scientists already knew, I repeat, they already knew the targeted delivery of modified RNA was impossible. Couldn't be done. Modified RNA cannot be targeted to specific cells. As such, it attacks perfectly healthy cells, even beyond natural barriers, like your blood-brain barrier. It can go into your brain. The continuous production of an artificial viral protein robs the cell of energy, disrupts its metabolism, and leads to the cell no longer being able to perform its vital tasks for the organism as a whole. What's worse, with virus proteins generated in them, those cells are subsequently destroyed by our immune system. In lay language, it means you're creating an autoimmune condition in every single person that got the vaccine. Despite these dire shortcomings, Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna launched a large-scale production of COVID-19 vaccines using the modified RNA. The body responds differently to natural infection versus modified RNA injection. Spike protein is well known to represent, listen carefully what I'm about to say. I'll repeat this slowly. Quote, spike protein is well known to represent a poison for our body. In the case of natural infections, our immune system will prevent the virus from infecting our body cells by neutralizing it via specific antibodies, with the possibility of cross-immunity being effective also against virus variants. With a modified RNA injection, our immune system does not have a chance to prevent the lipid nanoparticles from transferring modified RNA into our cells, all cells, not just some cells, with the appropriate receptor for binding of the virus, as would be the case with natural infection. The virus and the vaccine are not the same. Though some have argued that the body's response to the modified RNA vaccine is similar to a response to the actual virus, that is not true. First, let us look at the natural virus and our body's response to it. The virus RNA is like a blueprint. It contains instructions for all parts needed, not just for spike protein, to make a new virus. The virus RNA exists within a protein envelope. Our immune system would build various antibodies, not just around spike protein, thus building up some degree of cross-immunity to deal with virus variants. And the majority of the respiratory viruses are prevented from entering our body by the immune system located in the oral and nasal mucosa. The virus does not inject its RNA into blood vessels, but binds to a specific receptor on the cell surface and then directly injects RNA into the cell. It must be emphasized that only specific cells, namely those carrying the appropriate receptor on the cell surface, can be infected. Our immune system's job is to destroy a cell that has been infected with a virus to prevent replication of the virus and subsequent infection of new cells. Notably, our immune system will stop the process once that battle is won, typically within a few days. Next, let us examine the body's response to the modified RNA injection, the vaccine. The vaccine contains modified RNA for only the spike protein. Therefore, vaccination provides no cross-immunity. The vaccine's modified RNA has no protein envelope, but is instead wrapped by a lipid nanoparticle. Lipid nanoparticles will not need receptors to enter a cell. Lipid nanoparticles are built of lipids as is the cell membrane. Therefore, both lipid membranes will simply merge. The immune system generates antibodies to combat antigens, which could include a pathogens, virus and bacteria, and foreign particles like fungi, spores, allergens, or any substance that provokes a specific immune response. However, the lipid nanoparticles that transport the modified RNA vaccines are devoid of these antigens, enabling them to bypass the specific immune system unnoticed and induce non-specific inflammation. This dynamic triggers an escalation in the immune system's activity, leading to the production of an increasing quantity of antibodies against the spike protein. Each subsequent booster dose of lipid nanoparticles delivers an escalating quantity of modified RNA. This in turn prompts an uninterrupted production of new spike proteins, and vaccines are injected into muscles. However, it is nearly impossible to inject directly into a muscle cell, large syringe versus small cell. As muscles are strongly supplied with blood, very often syringes will violate blood vessels. The normal situation will be that the vaccine will be placed between the muscle cells, the so-called intercellular space. Fluid in the intercellular space will be collected as lymph fluid, finally merging with the blood. The vaccine and booster modified RNA will continue to produce spike protein for weeks, even months, which is entirely different from a natural infection, as our cells' machinery, e.g., the enzyme RNase, cannot destroy the artificial modified RNA. Researchers have found that some severe cases of COVID-19 were not due to the presence of the virus, but to the dysregulation of the immune system called the cytokine storm. And then it goes on to how poor the safety review was, going clear back to 2018, and it's all laid out by one of the world's leading scientists specializing in this field. I just thought I would share that with you because you won't hear that anywhere else. This was exclusive on our program today. We're giving you information. What you do with it, of course, is your choice. But those who are not looking at this should, because this means that every single person on the planet who got the vaccine was not aware they were getting a modified RNA. And as a result, a lot of the misinformation that was given about how safe it is and effective and not to worry, that was misinformation. Possibly innocently, but in the case of Fauci and others, not innocent. They knew. They had the research at hand. You were lied to. And that's unfortunate, because now we're dealing with the consequences, and they are severe. Now, we're going to go to a clip. And this is an interesting clip. This person's name is Amala, A-M-A-L-A, Ekpunobi, E-K-P-U-N-O-B-I. She's an African-American, 22-year-old, who, according to her, in her own comments, was as radical as you can get. She was filled with hate and loathing. She supported Antifa and Black Lives Matter and all the... If it was something to join that made you against, you know, the completely, totally, 100% racist police, every one of them was racist, and Caucasians, she was up for it. And then one day, something happened that changed her whole way of thinking. And that was, she was stopped by a cop. And you'll hear in her own words, when the cop stopped her, she started to cry, her body was shaking, because possibly in her own mind, she thought, well, this is an average cop, he's going to come up and either arrest me or shoot me. Anyhow, the cop came up and she rolled down the window. He says, not to worry. He said, I just want to let you know that you're going a little too fast, and just, I'm not going to give you a ticket or anything. I just want you to be more cautious and not go so fast. And then I walked away. And then she says, quote, well, that's unusual. I wasn't expecting that. Is he the only non-racist cop in America? Or is there something I'm missing? So she went home and she started to do her own research, because as you hear her say repeatedly, everything she knew, everything she was against, everything about being a victim, everything was taught to her. And then she started to see there was a different point of view, and that confused her. She reached out for help to understand this, and she was immediately attacked. And there, it was vicious attacks from friends and people close to her. So you're either 100% in a believer, or you're the enemy. And then she started to be more educated, and finally, she left that far-left position she was at. And this is a talk done at Washington University, St. Louis, about why I left the left. Interesting. Now, you can agree or disagree with her, but here's what's interesting. There are an awful lot of young people who, if you have a conversation about them and what they're angry about, what they resent, you may find truth in some of it, but you may find a lot of it's just propaganda that people are not doing their own homework and just passing forward. If there's anything we need today in the world, it's conciliation, cooperation, working together, because we of different races, of different religions, of different belief systems, of different careers, of different ages, we're not the enemy of each other. But we're acting as if we are. We should be working together against those that are our true enemy. Corporate, the vulture corporate corporations who use vulture capitalism to take away our rights, and governmental agencies that have been compromised, and the social media that have worked in hand with the media and corporate interests and governmental agencies to see you don't get an honest, objective picture of anything. So listen to what she has to say. And again, call in, disagree or agree. But we need to have more people coming forward who have been hard-driven, true devotees, like a cultist, who now have a different perspective, and they're sharing that with you. So anything you find that she says you feel is inaccurate, challenge it, call it out, as I did with earlier this week with the person I debated on Tuesday night. We go to the clip now.
Hello, everyone. I want to say it's such a pleasure to be here. I want to thank you, Nathaniel, for making this all happen. And I want to thank the College Republicans for being willing to host me. Apparently, that's a very brave thing to do, as I am a very harmful and threatening transphobe. So it is nice to meet every single one of you. Hopefully, I'm not as scary as you thought I might be. And today, I just want to start off by introducing myself. My name is Amala Epinobi. I'm 22 years old, and I'm currently working at PragerU, hosting a show called Unapologetic and talking about my beliefs on social media, which I'm very blessed to be in the position to do on a day-to-day basis. I'm by no means an intellectual. I'm simply somebody who went through an ideological transformation and am now in the space where I share that with people, because by virtue of being born a Black female, my voice has become abundantly important in today's day and age. Not that it should be because of my race and my gender, but because we've set ourselves in an ideological hole where now I'm able to say things that a lot of people are unable to say in today's climate. So I figured I should share my story with you so that all of you can get to know me, for those of you who don't know me already. I was born and raised in a small rural conservative town in Central Florida, and I happen to be raised by a single mother of three. My mom happens to be white, and although I don't view that to be particularly important, it becomes important to my story as I'm raised and as I progress. I often think back to what my earliest political memory would have been as a child, because my mom happens to be a very active leftist. She works for a left-leaning organization back in Florida, works on virtually any left-leaning campaign you can think of. She's at the forefront, knocking doors, talking to people, doing development and fundraising for these endeavors. So my mom is very proud of what I do now, as you can probably imagine. But I think my earliest political memory was in 2008. I was 8 years old at the time, and I remember being super excited on this particular day because my mother said I could stay up past my 9:30 bedtime. And the reason she said that was because we were going to find out who the president of the United States was. And I sat down in front of the television with my mother, my little sister, and my brother, and we watched as the results rang in and rang in and rang in. And slowly but surely, I was very tired and exhausted, but we got our results. And my mother sat in front of the television and right, started so bawling her question. Eyes out. I mean, she was crying harder than I'd seen this woman cry in a long time because Barack Obama was president. And I remember looking at her and going, why are you crying? This is the guy that you've knocked doors for months now. You've been screaming and crying about people voting for him. You've been using his hope slogan everywhere you go. You're wearing the t-shirts, the signs outside the front door. And she looked at me and my siblings and said, this is such a historic day. I'm so glad you're here to see this. I never thought such a racist country would elect a Black president. And in that moment, I recognized, I think, a few things, that one, being Black in America is super important, and two, that a lot of people don't like that, don't like to see Black people in civil society. So that was one message that was put forth in my brain as a young child, and there would go on to be more and more. I remember my mother, as we would go around to grocery stores, would say, you know, we're going to get a lot of weird looks from white people, because they don't think that me as a white person should have a Black child. And that stung. And now every single cross look that I got or curious look that I got from a white person was racism. She would tell me, when people ask to touch your hair, when the white kids at school asked to touch your hair, which happened all the time, it was in a white neighborhood, that's a microaggression. It's actually racism being committed against you, and you should take a strong stance and a firm stance and tell them not to ask questions about your hair, not to ask questions about your skin tone, and to, in fact, keep away from those subject matters altogether. Okay, I learned that. I remembered that. And I was, as you can probably imagine, a very angry young person. I thought that this country was built on the backs of people who look like me, and historically, it very much was. And I thought that that was still present to this day, that this country was made only for white, cisgendered, heterosexual, as we hear it now, people to benefit from all of the institutions and systems that lied before me. And I thought that even if I tried as hard as I possibly could to get success in this country, there would constantly be barriers placed in front of me simply because I was born the way I was born. So yeah, I was super angry, and I would not shut up about it. I was the kid in middle school who was constantly having political conversations when nobody gave a damn about politics. I was showing up to speech classes and talking about being pro-choice in an America that hates women. And the next week I was talking about the prison industrial complex. And then the week after that, I was talking about systemic racism and policing, all while being, you know, 13, 14 years old. And I went through middle school being that exact person, dedicating myself to this perceived victimhood that I had. And then I went into high school and I did the same thing. I was the student activist. I was wearing the Black Lives Matter t-shirts and the I Can't Breathe shirts. And I was organizing students whenever political conversations were injected into our school. And like I said before, I grew up in the state of Florida. So we were in no shortage of political turmoil and problems to discuss. At 16, I got a tattoo, and I'm going to show you this tattoo on my arm here, and it's a cool little Black power fist. Regrettably, I have this tattooed on my arm. I would say don't let your 16-year-olds get tattooed. If there's anything that you learn from this speech, I hope you take that away with you. But I have this marked on my arm because I had subscribed myself to an ideology that was quite religious in practice. And I thought, there's no way I deviate from the sentiments that I hold now. There's no way I deviate from this identity and from this bond that I have with my own victimhood in this place that I'm living in now. So why not put it on my body for everybody to see? Why not brand myself with this message for everybody to see? And then eventually in Florida, the Parkland shooting would happen, and an uproar happened not only in the state of Florida, but across America. And we started seeing young people come to the forefront of every single political conversation. And they were all being affirmed, regardless of what it is that they felt, regardless of how well studied they were and the things that they were talking about. And I thought, I'll do that. I've been doing it throughout middle school and high school. Sign me up. I'm not really well educated on the issue that I'm talking about, but I'll be the person who gives the speech. And I got offered a position to speak at the March for Our Lives in Orlando. And I got up on the stage, wrote this whole speech full of talking points, somehow made the issue about systemic racism, and I gave that speech in front of tens of thousands of people. And from there, I graduated high school. I was really good at running my mouth back then. I still am to this day. And I thought, hey, why do I need to pursue higher education? Right now, we are in this perpetual struggle. And it's a perpetual struggle that if young people don't do something about it now, if I don't go and galvanize other young people behind this struggle, I'm not going to get anywhere. And that tenet is baked into the ideology itself. You have to go convince other people. You have to rally. You have to build an army to fight what became an invisible villain. And I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll become a youth organizer and I'll talk to my mom and get a job at her organization. So I did that. And I got hired as a youth coordinator. And that meant that I was traveling around to different middle schools and high schools in my area and talking to other young people, some who were disillusioned with the current political system, some who were already leaning left, some who were apathetic, and giving them the same lessons that I was taught as a young person, making them hypercognizant of their race and their gender and exactly where they stood on the ladder when it came to comparing themselves to other people in this country. Having them take privilege tests, which is something that's pretty common now, having them check their privilege and rank themselves on their intersectionality, all these fun little buzzwords that we talk about and see so often today. And I ran around doing that and I was so passionate. I thought I was changing the world, which is how so many young people feel right now. And it's important to find something that you value. It's important to find a great struggle or a great fight. And that was mine. And I would go around and tell all these adults about the job that I was doing. And they'd go, you're just like Obama. And my 8-year-old self was cheering in front of the television again. And I felt like, oh, I'd come full circle on this. So a lot of people ask, what was your wake up moment? What made you change your ideology, or what made you have that flip? What flipped the light switch on? And to that I say there wasn't really an aha moment. There wasn't a light switch. It was a gradual process of me being confronted with things that didn't quite make sense and trying at every single turn to reject it and ignore it and go back to what I knew, go back to what I was familiar with, and go back to the lens that I was looking through the world at. And that was the lens of gender and race and sexuality. So I kept working at this organization, and I'll tell a few stories that led to me sort of opening my mind a little bit. Leftist organizations host meetings like any other organizations do. However, mine did something a little different. We'd start our meetings off with something called community agreements, which essentially involves a coworker coming up and writing on a board a list of rules that we'll follow before we get into the meeting. Really funny sayings like, don't yuck my yum, or make space, take space, or say your pronouns before you get on with the point that you're trying to make. And one day, my coworker got up, she started writing the community agreements on the board as I was used to, and she got to the last one. And she wrote, and to all the white cisgendered people in the room, maybe don't speak at all. You've had the floor for long enough. We're taking our time back. You're no longer a part of the conversation. And I felt something go, oof, that did not feel right. Because I know I'm going to do this job. And then tonight I'm going to go home to a white family that has taken care of me my entire life, that made sure if I wanted to go to school, I went to school, made sure I was working hard, made sure I was always accounted for, and made sure I was happy and healthy. So something was wrong about that statement, but I couldn't quite piece it together. And I looked around at a room of people who all nodded, some even laughed, some clapped. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I'm in the wrong room, but I'll ignore that for now. And I went back to work and back to work and back to work. And one day I got pulled over by a police officer, which was my worst nightmare at the time. In retrospect, it was very irrational. But I had grown up with the stories of Tamir Rice and Michael Brown and Eric Garner. I watched the video of Philando Castile getting shot by a police officer when it came out. And I also got the attached narrative that this was a hunting down of Black people in the streets of this country that nobody wanted to acknowledge. So I get pulled over by a cop. The lights are flashing behind me. I pull the car over to the side of the road. And to my dismay, a white male police officer gets out of the car. And I feel detached from the memory as I'm talking about it, but at the time, it was horrifying. I mean, I was crying, shaking, just completely hysterical before this man had ever even made it to the window. And he gets there, roll it down, and he looks at me and just sees this child sitting in her own tears. And I like to think that he maybe recognized what the culture was around his job at the time, what people were saying, sort of the climate around his occupation. And he said some very important words to me. He said, "Ma'am, I am not here to hurt you. You were just driving a little too fast. I'm not even going to give you a ticket. Just collect yourself and drive home." And he walked away. And I went, damn. Either A, somebody has lied to me about how this situation was going to go down, or B, I just met the one good cop in America, and it could very well be B. So I left that situation and didn't really ask any further questions, but the thought was still in the back of my mind. And I continued to go to work, and I continued to hear the same rhetoric, specifically blatant racism towards white people. And one day I thought, I should bring these concerns to somebody who's higher up in this organization than I am. And I went and I sat down and scheduled a meeting with the VP of the organization. And I said, this is not really adding up for me, because we're claiming to be anti-racist. We're claiming to be tolerant. We're claiming to be accepting of all people. But we are doing the exact opposite of that. And I raised those concerns, and he looked me dead in my face and said, "You just don't know how oppressed you are. And it's not my fault that you don't know how oppressed you are. It's really not my job to teach you about that oppression. And hey, you're just not as angry as you should be." Final straw for me, a few weeks later, ended up leaving that organization and never looking back. But I still had all these questions that I had built for myself throughout the time that I worked there. And I did what any young person would do, and I went to the internet. And I started off with the issue of police, because that was at the forefront of my mind. And I want to make it very clear, I didn't go to the internet to challenge what I believed. I went to the internet to reinforce what I believed. I wanted the stats that were going to tell me exactly why I was right about this preconceived notion, this preconceived bias, this prejudice that I had towards police officers. And I went and I searched, and a PragerU video popped up, just to really stab in the irony a little bit. And it was a video titled, "Cops Are the Good Guys." And I looked at that video title and I thought, this is going to be the most racist video I've ever watched. Click. And it ended up being a former sheriff who happened to be Black named David Clark. And he's detailing his life as a police officer, going through the stats on the things that I was concerned about. And I went, ooh, I might be wrong about that. And if I'm wrong about that, what else am I wrong about? And I went down this rabbit hole of finding conservative thinkers, classically liberal thinkers, Dave Rubin at the time, who was identifying as a liberal, and watching their videos, finding Larry Elder, Thomas Sowell, who has had the greatest impact on me as a person in the way that he approaches these issues. And something flipped. And I didn't flip all the way. There are still plenty of liberal or left-leaning views that I still hold dear to myself, but I recognized that something about this wokeness that was happening in the modern day was not for me and probably not very beneficial for society. So I took in those ideas and continued down the rabbit hole. And one day, probably about a year and a half later, I downloaded an app called TikTok. regrettably. And I downloaded it and started searching through it. And I'm sure you're all familiar, but TikTok takes in your demographics and it knows, you know, who they're marketing to when they give you videos, and they give you those curated videos on your For You page. And I started getting videos on my For You page that were like me looking at my old 16-year-old self. I mean, these young girls talking about Black victimhood and modern day feminism and all these things. And I went, wow, is there nothing on this app to counteract what I'm seeing here? Why don't I tell my story and put that in a 60-second video? And I put it on the platform and it blew up, and not in the good way. People hated it. I mean, they hated it. I was called a coon, an Uncle Tom, a race traitor. People were telling me I needed to give my Black card back to them, that they don't claim me, even though I thought we were done claiming people in the modern age. But those are the comments that I got. And I said, okay, well, clearly people need to hear this. So I started making more videos and making more videos, and they ended up taking off in some surprise way. And I left the job that I was working at the time was very politically neutral, and said, okay, I'm going to pursue this, and started working at PragerU. Now, I became semi-obsessed with how this all happens. I'm going to check the time to make sure we're not going too long here. And I wanted to find the pipeline for how these views become so normalized in society, because I know we feel like these are longstanding sets of ideologies. And in some ways they are, because they were implemented or seeded a very long time ago. But this fresh new opening of woke ideology is very new for the most part. So I started to look into how these things come out of this pipeline and how they enter the world we're in today. And it seems to be that academia is the problem when it comes to this. And you can swap out any theory you want to talk about. I mean, for the sake of today, we can talk about critical race theory. A lot of these things start with a moral impulse, which is really important to acknowledge, because a lot of conservative speakers will come and look down on people who are left-leaning. And I by no means want to look down on anybody who is left-leaning. That was me 4 years ago. I don't see any problem with that. And I think that most people who are left-leaning because they feel that it's the compassionate right thing to do. And I don't want anybody to get that twisted. But it starts with the moral impulse. The moral impulse that's present in critical race theory is that because we discriminated against Black people and people of color in the past of this country, and legally so, we should discriminate in the present to make up for that. At least that's how it is done in practice. So we start with this moral impulse brought about by the likes of Jean Stefanstick, Derrick Bell, Richard Delgado, Kimberly Crenshaw, who are names you'll find if you look into OG critical race theorists. So they have this idea and they go, okay, well, we need to back this idea up. I should write a journal about this. And they start writing. And the interesting part is there's a lot of truth within these journals, which is why it's so enticing for people. It's why I believe the things that I believed, and it's why many do to this day. America did some pretty messed up stuff to Black people and people of color. Slavery, not cool. I don't know that anybody really needs to hear that or that I need to say that. But not cool. Jim Crow, not cool. Definitely happens. Definitely needs to be acknowledged as a transgression. But do we fix that transgression with present discrimination? No. But that's what critical race theory posits, and that is what is written. In fact, they say that racism is so baked into this country that every facet of our society and your life will be met with racism as a person of color in this country. That's what Derrick Bell says, at least. So they write these moral impulses and their set of guidelines for how we deal and assess these moral impulses in these journals, and then they get published. Journal, publish, journal, publish, journal, publish. And they're already working in academic institutions, and they get tenured in these academic institutions. And then what's written in these journals becomes classes. And from those classes, you get schools of devotees who have listened to every single word you've written, taken that to heart, learned it all throughout their college career, and then they leave college to work in other spheres of influence, in media, in corporate America, Hollywood and entertainment, the public school system, you name it. There are people who graduated learning these tenets who then go on to implement it in some way, shape, or form where they are now. So that's how it grows, starting in academia, moving, jumping, changing, shifting, being distilled down, which is why so many people will look you directly in the face and say critical race theory is not being taught in schools. It's a law theory. I've never heard of a law theory being taught to kindergartners, but when you learn the law theory, leave college and move on to some other sphere within our society, guess what? You can distill those ideas down in a way that kindergartners start to understand exactly what you're getting at. And you would imagine that when people are coming up with these ideas and teaching them in schools, that somebody would raise their hand and say, you know what? I don't agree with what you just said there. And I would like to be forward about disagreeing. How have those people not stomped out a lot of what we're dealing with right now? But interestingly enough, these ideologies safeguard themselves from criticism. How? By labeling you as a racist or a transphobe or a homophobe or a fatphobe. And you'll find that with all of these theories, there's a set of insults coupled with them that will get thrown at them. Which is why when it was announced that I would be speaking at this school, a whole op-ed was written about how I'm a misogynistic, racist, transphobe, which is just quite the introduction, I must say. And I liken it, or at least analogize it, as waking up one day and finding that there is a prison built around you, at least a prison of ideas. And you go, wait a second, this is not in my house. Somebody's trapped me in this prison. And naturally, you try to escape. And the people who built the prison around you beat you down and they call you a criminal. Except this time it's racist or transphobe or homophobe or misogynist, when in this day and age, it's one of the worst things that you can be labeled as, which is why so many people are so scared. So that's how these ideas are born and propagated, and how we get to being in a position that we are now, where liberal education is anything but liberal. You have a 22-year-old girl who wants to come and speak at a college campus and is met with just a barrier to even come and espouse views that might challenge the mainstream held views of not just students, but faculty members. And that should be the scariest part. We're all young people. We all go through our trials and tribulations, and we certainly love to judge people. There was nothing I loved more in the world when I was 17 years old than judging somebody, calling them a racist, and telling them that they should shut up. That's normal for young people. But for adults and faculty members to look at speakers who are coming to simply espouse their beliefs and say, you should not be allowed on a college campus, where I as an adult am meant to be encouraging young minds to at least hear something that they might disagree with, that they might contend with.
So you could say bye to,
and that's a beautiful thing, to listen to something that you disagree with, because you either A, leave with a changed mind, or you leave with your beliefs being reinforced. And what a beautiful thing to have gone through an hour of listening to somebody and leave having your beliefs be stronger than they were before. And that's something I'm totally open to. In fact, I encourage, and I hope there are left-leaning people here today listening.
Okay, you've been listening to Amala Ekampombi giving a speech at Washington State University in St. Louis. Again, you can agree or disagree with anything she's saying, but right now, she is one of the most popular voices in the entire world on her podcast, and I'm not here to say she's right or wrong in any of this. I'm here to say that we should be having civil dialogues on how we got to be in such a chaotic, negative, toxic state, where we're not patient, we're not thoughtful, we're not looking to hear someone else's opinion, where we can then challenge our own opinions, which we should be doing, because we're not all living at the same level. By the way, I got to say goodbye to WBA audience, but now we're going to have Kathy Davis on, long time, dozens of years on WBAI in Pacifica, board member, and helping there, and also well known within the African American community as a conciliator, someone who comes together, brings together ideas, and sees what you have in common. She's an agent of peace. Hear her comments after listening to this today.
Thank you. This is Catherine Davis, and I had a chance to listen to a talk by Amala Ekwunobi at Washington University entitled Why I Left the Left. And I resonate with this in some manner because I have felt very much disappointed with the so-called left.
Gary, do you want the whole comments to play out, or do you want to stop at the top of the hour?
Turnaround with regard to many of the promises that were made to people of color, poor people, with regard to many, many issues, with regard to economics, with regard to education, with regard to healthcare. It seems that the political left has turned their backs on the people that they claim to represent. But with regard to this particular talk by Amala, I'm actually quite inspired by her courage and her willingness to come out with her viewpoints despite the pushback that she's receiving. It's become very difficult for anyone in this current climate to be able to express their true opinions, their assessment, or even the facts of the case. And we need to really provide the forums that allow all of these perspectives to come forward so that we can begin to have conversations about them and to resolve them. That's not going to happen if every time someone speaks, they're going to be bullied or pushed out of the marketplace of ideas simply because of that disagreement. And what this is causing is more and more division between people. And that division is preventing all of us from finding that common ground that will allow us to be able to resolve issues, to really look at the real problems. One of the things that I found very enlightening about this talk was with regard to the process by which our current state has taken place, starting out in think tanks, starting out in universities, beginning to educate people in a certain way about ideologies and how to implement those ideologies. And then that first line of people who've embraced this perspective go out into the marketplace, into the schools, onto the broadcasts of media networks, mainstream, and as well as independent. And we've been, as a collective of the human race, we've been drawn into this boiling pot of conflict that prevents problems from being resolved. So yes, I am inspired by this young woman who has the courage to speak up in a manner that contradicts the status quo and challenges the so-called left and the perspectives that are being driven at this point into not just the media marketplace, but into law and into activism, so that rather than activists solving problems or seeking solutions or going into a process of communication and debate, young people are motivated to jump on the bandwagon, become attack dogs within the media.
And that's Kathy Davis. Unfortunately, I have to cut Kathy off because we're out of time. And it is the purpose of my work to show what we have in common, to show the uniqueness of each person's contribution and what we're capable of doing when we work together. You're not the enemy. I'm not the enemy. But we're made to believe we are. We shouldn't be judging people by their religious beliefs or their age or where they're at in the social stratosphere of our society, our ethnicity. We are all spiritual. We're all sentient. Let us act that way. But of course, there are those that have a different motive. They have a different agenda. They want to keep us fighting one another while they get away with crimes against humanity. Thank you all for listening and watching, and I look forward to our next program. And by the way, right now, Black Agenda Report. Please stay tuned.